It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Today we're going to be talking about two big items. The first is how Biden has approached the situation at the border and essentially continued a lot of Trump-era policies, both in terms of keeping refugees out and also in terms of the militarization of the border, but also working with governments in so-called Latin America to basically extend the U.S. border beyond its reach, to militarize the borders of other governments, which is something that happened under Trump, of course. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to be talking about the situation in Minneapolis, both in terms of the ongoing Derek Chauvin trial and also the recent killing of this latest person, the 20-year-old African-American man that was shot and killed by, according to news reports, a longtime veteran of the police force and also the head of the police union there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're just going to get into it in terms of what's going on with the border and Biden's policies towards it. You know, a couple weeks ago, there were these pictures that started to kind of circulate of conditions within immigrant detention facilities. And the conditions, of course, have remained just as horrible as ever. I mean, these things are overcrowded. They're just essentially like warehousing human beings. People are sleeping on floors with these like tiny aluminum blankets. I mean, there seems to be no attempts to like give people, you know, any sort of, you know, nice accommodations or, you know, just help them out. People are packed together. It seems that they're in environments where disease obviously is spreading, could be spread, especially COVID. There's been lots of reports of sexual abuse and children being abused by guards. I mean, there's all sorts of things. There's also been numerous deaths that have happened at these institutions. So there's been a lot of heat under the Biden administration for that. But also there's been a lot of other reports that have come out. The first one is that the Biden administration is continuing to uphold Trump-era policies of keeping refugees out of the country. And also the other aspect is the militarization of the border. So let's kind of jump into both of these things and tease these out, what's happening.
Yeah, so on a super high level, there's a number of things that are happening right now, which are kind of a slight modification of what happened before, but only slightly. And I want to be very clear about how slight these differences are. So, like, let's talk about the differences first. The first difference is that the Biden administration ended the stay in Mexico policy. So for those of you that don't remember, what that was a policy under the Trump administration, which said that migrants and specifically refugees had to stay in Mexico until they were able to have their court cases processed. So essentially what you would do is you would cross the border, you would get detained by Border Patrol, and you would get sent back. And then you would stay somewhere, theoretically, where they could contact you, and you would, in theory, show up for your court date. That's not how anything worked, obviously. Of course, as people got sent back to Mexico, they were not able to be contacted. People couldn't cross the border to show up for their court hearings. There, you know, so it was chaos, right? And that was intentional. I mean, that was very obviously intentional, and it was meant to create human suffering. If anyone knows anyone that's done work along the border, the conditions in the camps that built up along the U.S.-Mexican border were atrocious. They were essentially ad hoc refugee camps, and without any of the international support that refugee camps tend to have. So there was a lot of disease. People were having a hard time finding food. It was awful. That ended, and so very quickly a large number of people tried to cross, as you would if you were fleeing a really dire situation. Now, what the Biden administration did in response to that was they started detaining people, and they started putting people back in camps, just on the U.S. side of the border. So very similar to what the Trump administration was doing in some circumstances, where they were sort of rounding people up and putting them in camps before then, in the Trump administration case, sending them back to Mexico. What's happening with the Biden administration is they're rounding people up and putting them into camps. And then, in some cases, they're releasing those people to, you know, a family member or friend or something like that. But in a lot of cases, in a large number of cases, they aren't. And in a lot of those cases, they are detaining people still in these camps, which are overcrowded, which are under-resourced, right? And they're still detaining children. So if a child crosses with a parent, then they're able to stay with their parents while they're being detained. But if they don't, they're still being imprisoned. And we are now housing migrant children at military bases and at a number of camps in Texas. Also very much like during the Trump administration, when someone gets released to a contact person, it's not like someone's helping them get to where that contact person lives. They're just sort of jettisoning them out, often in El Paso, Texas, and, you know, saying good luck, hope you find your person. And so a lot of people are sort of ending up in shelters and all kinds of other things, not able to get a bus ticket or something like that. And so that has continued as well. The border wall construction has continued. So one of the things that the Biden administration has said is that they were going to stop construction on new border fencing. And in some ways, that's true. In some ways, they have undone all the executive orders that existed under the Trump administration, which, say, for example, declared the, sort of migrant situation at the border to be a state of emergency, right? A national emergency. That got canceled. They canceled all of the Trump administration executive orders, which redirected Pentagon money down to being able to build the border wall. They've ended all of that. However, that doesn't mean that the border wall construction has stopped. And I think that this is really important to keep in mind. Some of that border wall money was allocated under Congress. And some of that was allocated out to contractors already who are currently actively building sections of the border wall. Now, from an executive branch perspective, they can't just unilaterally undo that. But if you look at how the Democrats in Congress have been acting, it's not like they've been rushing to undo this very much either, right? They've been sort of allowing it to, you know, sort of perpetuate and continue. They've been sort of really dragging their feet on this. A couple of them have gone down to the border camps to take pictures down at the border camp for their own sort of sense of publicity and things like that. But really nothing's changing. And so we have this big question in front of us right now. A lot of people, a lot of progressives and liberals were horrified by what happened under the Trump administration, very justifiably. It was atrocious, right? But they seem, and I'm sure I am saying this totally sarcastically, shocked that, you know, they seem entirely incapable of being shocked in the same way under Biden administration, right? They're not rising to that level of outrage anymore. This is happening in a wide variety of different sort of verticals within American life right now, where really nothing has changed very significantly. And yet the level of outrage has dropped dramatically because the person who's still perpetuating these things is, you know, not overtly a racist on Twitter or whatever. But to really think about the migrant question and the refugee question, we have to really dive into why there's a refugee crisis to begin with, coming out of Central and South America. And I mean, there's a number of reasons why. And I want to dive into some of these at a little bit of depth. So the first and very immediate reason that we're seeing right now, has a lot actually to do, specifically in the case of Venezuela, with oil markets. So 10 or 15 years ago, the United States was importing a lot of its oil. And in the process of importing oil, we were buying oil on the open market, and some of the biggest suppliers of oil in the world are countries like Venezuela and Iran and Russia. And about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a foreign policy decision that, quote, energy independence, to use the term that Obama used, was really, really important for maintaining U.S. global hegemony. And what started happening was they started drilling for oil domestically in the United States, and engaging in hydrofracking to extract natural gas. Now, we've seen some versions of this sort of pop up into public discourse, right? There's, of course, the conflicts happening over pipelines right now. Well, why are so many pipelines getting built right now? It's because we're engaging in domestic oil production, right? And domestic natural gas production. That's why so many pipelines are being built at the moment, right? The national parks have been opened up to drilling. That's because they have oil and natural gas under them, which are really, really crucial cornerstones for, quote, energy independence, right? Why are they drilling up in the Alaskan, you know, wildlife nature reserve in Anwar? Well, they're doing that because there's a lot of oil up there, right? Now, we hadn't been doing these things in the past. We've been buying oil on the open market. And so what the attempt is here, clearly, is be able to say, okay, well, we're going to produce oil domestically. We're going to produce natural gas domestically. And that's going to allow the U.S. state to be able to exert more leverage on a country like Russia or Venezuela or Iran. But there's problems with that approach. A lot of problems with that approach. First, and I think most immediate that we can see domestically, is it's catastrophic for the environment. Not only do oil pipelines leak all the time, but oil drilling is horrendous for the environment. Natural gas extraction is horrendous for the environment. We're poisoning groundwater supplies. We're, you know, leaking oil all over the place, right? It's a huge issue. I mean, let alone things like offshore drilling, which, you know, we all saw with what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, what happens when offshore drilling goes sideways. You end up with the biggest environmental disaster in human history pretty quickly. So that's one effect. Another effect has been all of these, quote, infrastructure protection bills, which are being passed all over the country, right? So we started seeing this in Standing Rock, where we saw state governments being really willing to use extreme levels of state violence to be able to protect, quote unquote, critical infrastructure, as they word it. Now, what we are now currently seeing is in a lot of states, in Ohio, Virginia, states like this, they either already have passed or are in the process of passing bills which criminalize very normal forms of protest. So, for example, with the bill in Ohio, if you block a road in the midst of a protest, so in the state of Ohio, and I looked this up before we recorded, jaywalking is a violation in most cities, right? Meaning that's a ticket. It's like a $30 fine, maybe, if you get ticketed at all. But somehow, if you're carrying a protest sign, it's a first-degree felony under this new law, right? If you chain yourself to anything, that's a felony. If you, you know, occupy a piece of land that a pipeline might go through, that's a felony, right? They're criminalizing basic forms of what I think even most of us would consider pretty light direct action, let alone forms of protest which are incredibly common in cities, like blocking roads, which I know where I'm at just happens as a matter of course at every demonstration. You just block roads because that's how you create space for your demonstration to happen. So what we're seeing on the second level effect is an increase in government repression and the justification of government repression. There's a lot of other elements to that, including the bleed over private intelligence companies and resource extraction companies into the military and police apparatus and things like this, which we could do a whole episode on just that. So that's what's happening domestically as a result of this attempt to sort of engage in domestic oil production. But internationally, specifically in South America, that has caused the slow motion collapse of the Venezuelan government. You know, under Chavez, there were these massive social programs that were launched in Venezuela, which were ridiculously popular amongst the Venezuelan population. And all of that was being funded by oil money. Under Maduro, one of the things that has happened is that oil revenues have dropped off significantly. And that has meant that the Venezuelan government does not have the money to continue to fund those programs. And that has led to massive social crisis, which has led to massive political instability in that part of South America, and a migrant crisis coming from Venezuela. You couple that with the fact that under Trump, the U.S. government legitimized and got very close to the regime of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. And for those of you that don't know, Bolsonaro is a, there's no other way to put it, he's a fascist. I mean, not in like a hyperbolic way. He legitimately believes in military dictatorships. He is a fascist. He also does not really believe in coronavirus. And so that is also creating a huge, massive impact on the Brazilian economy. Many, many, many people in Brazil are getting sick and dying, and there's people leaving, right? We also see the history of our involvement in Central America, right? We can see crisis in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala. These are all places where the U.S. government is directly complicit with the political instability of those places because of our involvement there, starting with the Reagan administration, with the Contras, right? And all of that was framed through the lens of the Cold War. And so if we think about this, we have a systemic crisis that is a result of U.S. global hegemony. And the response amongst the political class in the United States has either been, let's punish the migrants, right? So that's the sort of Trump response, or let's try and prevent them from getting to the United States at all, which has become sort of the Biden response, right? Which is like, let's militarize all the borders between where people are coming from and the U.S. and just make sure no one can get there. Yeah, he was.
I mean, under Trump, remember, they created that special police force, the National Guard,
yep,
within Mexico, whose job it was basically to police the migrants. And, you know, on This Is America, the podcast that we play on It's Going Down, we had the opportunity to talk to some people about the camps, because basically what will happen is people will come to the border of a country they're trying to cross into to get to the United States. So, for instance, people will come up to the Mexican border, and then there will be like a detention facility there, just like in the U.S. at, you know, the southern border. There will be detention facilities at the border where they're waiting to get their numbers to get called. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the conditions are bad, and the police are very brutal. But, yeah, there's several articles that you can read about just how they're militarizing each of these borders. So, you know, as we continue into a world in which, you know, they're projecting over the next, you know, a couple decades, you know, upwards of 100 million people might be displaced because of climate change. I mean, that's a very scary reality to live in, where all of these borders are increasingly militarized, increasingly policed. You know, the Democrats are pushing for more and more of, quote, a smart border, which we've talked about on this program before, but stuff like biometrics, the use of drones, infrared technology to basically police the border and rely not so much on like these silly kind of like, you know, big walls and stuff that Trump is, you know, fascinated with, that people can easily climb over or get under, but instead like actual technology that's going to stop people in their tracks. But at the same time, continuing what's already been in motion the last couple decades of pushing people farther and farther out into the desert, which has led to the deaths of, you know, tens of thousands of people.
Right. Well, and I think that this is really the important thing to emphasize here. Like, let's look at what the Democrats are proposing as the alternative, right? And you just mentioned it, the quote, smart border. So just to dive into that really quickly, like what they mean by that when they say that is that they are talking about a border which is for up to 50 to 80 miles off the border, right, into the U.S., full of motion sensors and tripwires and cameras and drones and border patrol. So instead of having like just a fence, or like a wall, if you want to call it a wall, essentially what we would end up with is a 50 to 80 mile deep fortress on the border, right? Which people that live along the border are not particularly happy about, nor are people trying to cross into the United States. And that's the Democrats' solution, on top of, you know, these vague promises of like pathways to citizenship and so on. But of course, if the goal is to have a quote pathway to citizenship, then you can't also simultaneously be doing every single thing that you can to prevent people from getting here, right? That essentially what is happening and what will continue to happen under any Democrat proposal is that the fallout of American action internationally, which is all being mobilized in order to maintain a sort of hegemonic position, militarily and politically and economically in the world, that the conditions generated by that are going to essentially not be addressed at all because they can't be. And instead, we're going to continue this process of throwing migrants and refugees into this sort of, you know, bureaucratic labyrinth where at best they can hope for some random judge somewhere in the country to say that they can stay here. And at worst, if they get thrown out, they've got nowhere to go. They can't go back home, right? Take, you know, people who live in a place like El Salvador. A lot of people coming here from El Salvador are coming here because of gang violence, right? Why is there so much gang violence in El Salvador? Well, that gang violence is directly attached to cocaine trafficking. Where is the, who is the largest consumer of internationally produced cocaine? The United States, right? That it's actually the drug war that has created the conditions for an organization like MS-13 to exist, right? That is also our fault. And so instead of fixing those issues, which would, of course, involve a dramatic decline of American power globally and very likely a, you know, huge systemic shift in how sort of international relations works. Instead of doing that, we're still going to try and figure out a way to punish the people who are victimized by this process and just do it in a way which feels better than what happened under Trump, but functionally leads to a lot of the same results, which is people not being able to flee extreme and immediate danger. When they are able to flee extreme and immediate danger, they end up becoming victimized by cartels. If they're able to avoid getting victimized by cartels and getting kidnapped and getting robbed on their way up to the U.S. border, then they're forced to try and cross through the deserts where many of them will die. And all of that is because they happen to just be unlucky enough to be born in a place that at some point in the last 40 years was important to American global hegemony. Right? We are punishing people, essentially. We are putting their lives at risk because we don't want to come to terms with what we did. We don't want to undo what we've done, right? We don't want to even admit what we did, let alone try and make it better. There's no attempt to do that, but that's pretty typical of Democrats, right? If we really look at the Democratic Party as a whole and we really look at the proposals they put forward, all of them are grounded in this notion that we can just fix all of our problems superficially, that none of these are caused systemically, that all we need to do is tweak a policy here and there. But I think increasingly more and more and more of us are aware that that's not going to cut it, that we have deep, deep, deep systemic problems here and that the rest of the world is paying the price for that. And that at some point, something needs to give, right? At some point, either there's going to be dramatic shifts internationally or there's going to be dramatic shifts domestically. But the current situation is not sustainable in any sort of way.
Life's a casino, I'm telling you. Everybody's playing, boys and girls, women, children, me and you. The dice are loaded and everything's fixed. Even a hobo would tell you this. Welcome to hard times. Feeling low, do you like sinning? No, well, you will be before you go. We got lots of gambling, oh, and we're telling lies. You're certainly welcome to hard times.
Let's move on to the situation in Minneapolis, and let's just dive into what's going on with the trial and what's happening with this latest police killing.
Yeah, so let's start with the Chauvin trial, because I think that that's particularly very fascinating. So first, it probably makes sense to kind of just go over super high level what's happening in this trial. Essentially, the prosecution is presenting the case that you would expect. They're showing the video, they're bringing up medical experts. They brought in a bunch of police commanders and use of force experts, which I'll get to in a second, because that's actually incredibly important. But the defense is running with this argument that George Floyd died for question mark reasons, pretty much any reason, except the knee on his neck for 9 minutes. The very obvious cause of death that we all saw happen right in front of our own eyes on video. They're trying to argue that, well, it wasn't that, it was literally anything else. Now, the problem that they've been having is multiple. Very specifically, that almost every single doctor that's looked at the video and looked at the medical reports and examined the body and blah, 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 has all come to exactly the same conclusion. Everyone who reviewed that work has come to exactly the same conclusion. And so the defense is resting on this case that George Floyd was a drug addict, that he had heart arrhythmia, that it was a heart attack that killed him because of the effects of drug use and so on, so on. But they have a problem, a number of problems with this argument. And they all sort of came out today. So we're recording this on the 14th. For those of you that want to go look back, they brought up an expert witness who I'm forgetting his last name. He's a doctor. His last name is Fowler. He used to be the medical examiner for the state of Maryland. Interestingly enough, he is currently the subject of a lawsuit because a series of years ago, a 19-year-old black male was murdered by police in a small town in Maryland by the cops kneeling on his neck and crushing his windpipe and killing him. And this medical examiner at the time searched for literally any other reason. He said, oh, well, the kid, you know, might have had alcohol in his system. You know, it could have been the carbon monoxide from the tailpipe of the car because, you know, he was on the ground when it happened, right? Like searching, you know, really searching for a reason. So as not to say that this was homicide. Now, today he testified and it just reinforced how poor the defense case is in this case. So he goes, oh, well, you know, there was carbon monoxide. And so the prosecutor goes, okay, well, but you saw the medical report, right? And he's like, yeah, it's like, there's no carbon monoxide content in his blood. So how can you say it was carbon monoxide poisoning? He goes, oh, but the car was on. How do you know the car was on? There was water dripping from the tailpipe, right? That's the answer. And the prosecutor goes, okay, so what you're telling me is that every single time there's water dripping from a tailpipe, that means a car is on. And the guy's like, well, no. Argument falls apart. Then he goes, oh, well, I saw in the video, right? This guy's like, I saw George Floyd had something white in his mouth, right? Which is kind of a common defense sort of point in their case. Prosecutor goes, okay, well, clearly you're implying that that was drugs. What we know and what you saw is that the level of fentanyl in George Floyd's system would have indicated that he took a moderate amount of fentanyl the day before, not right before he got dragged out of his car, as you're insisting. Also, can you tell me for sure whether that was a pill in his mouth? And the guy's like, well, no, I just said there was something white in his mouth. And prosecutor goes, okay, but you're inferring something here. Can you back up that inference? And he goes, no. Their entire case rests on a bunch of random conjecture and really creative readings of things that are very obvious. They're in deep trouble, the defense in this case. Now, we all know what happens when cops are on trial in the U.S., right? That does not mean that there will be a conviction, but the evidence is so clearly on the side of a conviction that even legal experts that write for the New York Times, the Washington Post, who generally only report on what's going on in a trial, have been reporting on how poor the defense case is, which is not normal. It's not something that's happened in past trials of police, that this is notably bad. But let's get to the second point, because I think the second point is actually a bit more important. Something kind of important happened in this trial. It tells us a lot about what we're about to see. The chief of the Minneapolis police a use of force expert for the Minneapolis police, a use of force expert from the LAPD, a firefighter from Minneapolis, all testified against Derek Chauvin. There's this idea in the United States amongst police, very much like amongst radicals, in which snitching is wrong, right? You just don't rat people out, period. Now, of course, it's super ironic for the cops to have that position, considering that they, you know, run informants all the time, and constantly try and turn people into snitches. But that's kind of the internal culture of what's going on. And that culture is held for a very long time. There have been whole books written about this, right? It's that apparent. And to a degree, some of that broke this week, but not in the way that would be the most relevant, right? What we did not see, even though many journalists and commentators are making this claim, I don't think that we can say that we have watched the sort of structure of, you know, universal police solidarity, internal solidarity, collapse. That's not what we've seen at all, right? There are plenty of things that many, many, many cops have to say about what their coworkers have done that are super illegal. For example, just this past week, there was a whole story released about people that are members of gangs within the LA Sheriff's Office, right? Within the Orange County Sheriff's Department in California. Nothing has been done about that, right? There are members of white supremacist groups in almost every major police department in the country. Nothing's being done about that. Cops run prostitution rings and deal drugs and all kinds of stuff all throughout Rust Belt cities. And every once in a while get caught. But it happens on an incredibly wide scale. Nothing's being done about that. What did happen is that the police in at least Minneapolis have mobilized to absolve themselves of responsibility. That what they came to that trial to do was not to say police violence is wrong. Because very obviously, just outside the trial, in Brooklyn Center, which is less than 10 miles away from the middle of Minneapolis, cops are tear gassing people and shooting them with rubber bullets. So very obviously, it's not a question of police violence being wrong, right? They're not getting up there talking about how cops victimize communities. They're not getting up there and talking about how the police in themselves are an occupying force in our lives. They're not doing any of that. They're not talking about how egregious the prison system is. None of it. What they're doing is they're going up there and saying, this one guy is bad and we need to get rid of people like him.
Which is ironic in this situation because this is a long-term veteran.
Yes.
That's literally the head of the police association.
Yes. Yeah. In Brooklyn Center, the cop who murdered Duante Wright is a 22-year police veteran and former president of the police union, like recently former president of the police union, right? Who claims that she thought she was firing her taser. And anyone that's ever held a taser and held a handgun knows they feel very different. Very, very, very different, right? But in the Chauvin trial, the Minneapolis police are going up there and trying to say, look, this guy was a problem, but we acknowledge that he was a problem, but he wasn't acting according to protocol. And that's actually the important point, because they're not going up there and saying we need to root out violent racist cops out of police departments. That's not what they're saying. They've never said that. They have not said that during this trial, even though many, many, many journalists who are overly naive really wish that they were saying that. And heard them saying that, even though they never did. All they said was that this cop and cops that violate protocol are the problem. So what that does is it essentially takes the anger that communities feel, takes the experiences that any person of color in a city has had, takes the experiences that any radical in this country has had, and essentially attempts to invalidate all of them. Because we all know that what happened to George Floyd is not the result of Derek Chauvin. We all know that what happened to George Floyd is the result of policing. Not just police in Minneapolis, but policing in general. A structure which is there intentionally to mobilize the logistics of violence, to impose will in our lives. Obviously, people are going to get hurt and killed in that process. That's kind of the whole point. That's sort of why they carry gun.
And we should remember, you know, the nature in which this whole incident began is that he was not available for a Zoom call. I saw one thing floating around online. I haven't seen this corroborated in the press, but supposedly there was a letter that was sent to an old address or the wrong address and he didn't get it. But anyway, regardless, you know, he was not on the call for a Zoom call about a fine that he owed. One was in relation to literally a marijuana charge, which is, you know, in itself a joke, but it was for a total of like $346 that he owed.
Yeah.
So because that he owed that very small amount of money, you know, probably what these police officers are making literally in a day, he had a warrant out for his arrest. So then when he got pulled over, and according to his mother, who he called while he was getting pulled over, he said, they're literally saying that I have an air freshener that's obscuring the view, which sounds exactly like driving while black. They said, oh, here's this guy. Maybe we can get something out of him. So they pull him over. And lo and behold, he has this warrant out because of this low amount of money that he owes for these basic fines. And he's got a warrant out for his arrest because he's missed a Skype call. And because of that, they try to arrest him. You know, there's a scuffle and then or some sort of incident. And you can obviously watch the video. And then this officer pulls out their gun and kills him.
Yep. Yeah. And so what we're watching here is we're watching a structure of state violence attempt to re-legitimize itself, right? And this tells us a lot about what we have seen as the uprising has sort of waned a bit, what we saw in 2014, and what we're seeing out of the Biden administration right now. And that is liberal counterinsurgency, right? The kind of Trump approach of let's crush the protests obviously failed, right? We were able to weather that. You know, it was scary. It was difficult. But we were able to weather that. What happens in more liberal areas, places like Minneapolis or in the Rust Belt cities, which are all run by Democrats or, and now federally, is this approach in which the state attempts to legitimize itself by portraying everything that occurs as an anomaly. So they say, oh, well, yeah, but Derek Chauvin's an anomaly. I mean, we didn't train people that way. If he would have acted the way we trained them, then this never would have happened. Or, yeah, I mean, sometimes maybe the, like, you know, consent decrees, any city with a consent decree, it's always based on this notion of, oh, yeah, I mean, maybe the cops are a little bit too violent, but all we have to do is, like, really tweak a policy here and maybe tweak a policy there and like maybe change the oversight process a little bit and so on, so on. And it'll just all fix itself. Right. Or what happens in a lot of cities is let's take the more moderate activists and bring them in to the process. Right. We saw this happen with the official quote unquote Black Lives Matter organization nationally where Patrice Cullors was brought in for the Democratic Policy Committee before the DNC, before the convention, to help write Democratic Party policy, right? This is a very common thing. But what happens in this process is that on one hand, the state is saying, okay, well, we will give you minor concessions as long as you agree to not challenge anything significantly, right? As long as you don't block roads and shut buildings down and siege police stations and stuff like that, you can have very cosmetic reforms. And maybe we'll even let you sit on a committee, right? I mean, let's look at how the whole defunding the police conversation has changed. Right at the beginning of the uprising last year, people were not asking to defund the police. People were not asking anyone anything. They were just driving the cops off the street. Right. They were not interested necessarily in a long drawn out policy process that was going to result in a cosmetic change. They wanted the cops out of their lives, off their streets. And in a lot of cities, they went about making that happen. But out of that came this whole discourse, which has sort of two wings. Okay. The first wing is, yeah, I mean, you want to get rid of the police, but that's a budget thing. So you should just like do a bunch of research and talk to your city council people and maybe they'll add you to a budget committee. And on that budget committee, maybe you can propose this. And, you know, if enough people inside the city government agree with you, blah, 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 blah. What that does is it removes struggle from the street, tries to delegitimize it, puts it in the hands of people who have a stake in perpetuating the political system, and then claims that that fixes the problem. Right? Yet those people that they bring into this process are not people who are often the people that are coming to these demonstrations. They're not grassroots organizers. They're not often in any sort of way people that exist on the fringes of the political process. Often the people that are brought in are people that are already affiliated with the Democratic Party in some way or another. Right? And so what they're doing is they're saying, okay, we're going to redefine the problem. We're going to redefine the process. We're going to claim that the political system is the only form of engagement that matters. And then we're going to bring our own people in and claim that they represent all the people on the street. That happens in like every single Rust Belt city. It is an incredibly common process. This uprising that we just saw was a result of that process failing in 2014 and 15. That they promised all of these reforms as long as people stopped blocking highways and rioting. And then nothing happened. That systematically police unions gutted even basic cosmetic reform. And so now when people are going out into the street, there's a pretty wide acknowledgement, at least amongst a lot of participants, that that process of just asking politicians and the cops to, like, you know, not impose their will through occupying our streets with organized violence doesn't actually work. Right? Because at the end of the day, for politicians to be politicians, to make laws, requires the police. If they want to impose their will on our lives, they need the cops there to do that.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. If you want to support It's Going Down and see us grow and continue into 2021, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. Give us a one-time donation or sign up to donate monthly or through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop. Thanks for listening. You can follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGD_news. Let's get back to it. To go on with the discussion, CrimeThink put out a piece that's interesting. On It's Going Down, you can actually see a roundup of the first night of the rebellion that kicked off in that neighborhood and spread throughout the U.S., and there's still protests going on. I know there's stuff called for tonight while we're recording this, some of them in the Bay Area, some of them other places. But in the CrimeThink thing, they brought up this one point, which I think is interesting. I would rather agree with it, but it said that kind of the you know, there's more buy-in from the public for certain tactics, that people are less kind of likely to go along with the line that, like, we have to be essentially, you know, passive and kind of quiet and demure and, you know, nonviolent, whatever that means. And that way the people in power will listen to us, and that way they'll acquiesce to our demands. I think, as we've seen with the George Floyd uprising and this recent round of rebellions, I mean, you know, the system moves very quickly when it wants to get people to settle down. I mean, already this police officer has resigned, and now they've been arrested and facing charges. It's almost like a mirror of, you know, what happened last summer. You know, these things happened very quickly as a way to try to tone things down. So I think that's an interesting dynamic. You know, the George Floyd uprising, as we've talked about, like, involved just tens of millions of people. And I think that kind of that snake oil that either the good people are being tricked by, you know, the bad shadowy revolutionaries or, you know, the white nationalist boogaloo boys or something like that. I mean, that kind of fiction, I think, is lost on people because they've lived through that experience and they've seen what it's like to be in those rebellions and see what's happened. And also just, you know, see the outcome of not only society shifting in a lot of ways and, like, people feeling their power, but also, like, seeing the state and the police react and having to kind of give up these kind of reforms as limited as they are. I think the other aspect, too, that wasn't discussed in the CrimeThink piece is the dynamic of the attempted pro-Trump coup that happened on January 6th. I think what's interesting there is that we heard a lot of people on the right for months and months defending those people, saying, like, oh, well, you know, they weren't damaging,
you know, they weren't hurting people. They were just, you know, spreading poop over, you know, a building, or, you know, they stole some stuff, yeah, or they engaged in like minor property damage, like, you know, calm down. Like, so, you know, we've been hearing stuff from that. So basically from the right, we've been told kind of this complete reversal where they've been running around for like the past year screaming about, quote, whole cities burning down. Yeah. But yet when their team is the one destroying property, oh, it's okay and it makes sense because, you know, they're fighting for, quote, a revolution, mm-hmm, or to, against, you know, stopping the steal. Basically, according to them, you know, trying to preserve democracy. But in reality, what they were trying to do is create this dictatorship, which they openly talked about. I mean, this is the reason they talked about Trump crossing the Rubicon, was that they wanted him to openly begin to be more authoritarian and use the military, use the police against the people that they didn't like and stay in power and lock up all the Democrats and so, yeah, on and so forth.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is sort of getting into the sort of second wing, of what's happening right now, which I think is fascinating, right? So on one level, yeah, what's happening is that there's starting to be a pretty wide acceptance of direct resistance as a legitimate series of tactics. Right. And a lot of that has to do with frustration. A lot of that has to do with normalization. Right. It has just happened now and people have experienced it.
It's going to be really hard for them to come in and say like, oh, these are all Antifa. These, yeah, are all Black Lives Matter revolutionaries. These are all anarchists or whatever. I mean, obviously there's political radicals and activists out in the streets, just like there are whenever something happens. But I mean, these are everyday working class, yeah, people that are taking to the streets. And not only that, but it's like out of the millions of people and thousands that are taking part in these actions, I mean, who do you think that if they did vote, who do you think they voted for, you know, a couple months ago?
Yeah.
Across the board, these are all Biden voters, and these are people in blue states, mm-hmm, under blue mayors, mm-hmm, under blue direct, you know, DAs, under a Democratic president. Mm-hmm. And I think the Democrats have to deal with that reality, and I think that's another interesting question, is just like, how do they deal with that,
yeah,
very real thing that these are essentially people that voted for them, that in many ways a lot of these people out there showing their frustration probably thought that Biden was going to make it better.
Sure. Yeah. So the Democrats have a problem right now in that they tried to, throughout the election, create a counterinsurgency dynamic. They tried to say, here's the good protesters and here's the bad ones. The good ones we need to bring into the system and like get them involved in politics, and the bad ones we need to like get a bunch of police weapons and repress horribly. The problem is that almost nobody bought that line of argumentation, right? The right wing thought that was just a way to justify cracking down on them because, you know, they live in paranoid fever dreams all the time. But for those of us that were coming from our perspective, we were sitting there going, oh, okay. Well, I mean, but this uprising has popular support, and it did. And so the attempts to really crack down on the uprising really met with a lot of resistance in the United States because of the dynamic that we were just talking about. People started to recognize the legitimacy of direct resistance. But what happened on January 6th was fascinating, right? So there was this inverse dynamic, right? On one hand, a whole group of people started accepting property destruction as a legitimate technique. But on the other, the Democrats started using that on January 6th as the way to justify crackdowns. And what they've been saying, and this is not just in the form of new counterterrorism powers, which we talked about on the show a couple of months ago, but and are definitely still very much in the works. But more importantly, what they're starting to say is, well, I mean, there's acceptable forms of resistance. You know, like you can protest, you can have signs, you can even block roads. That's okay. And these darn Republican states trying to criminalize blocking roads. That's just repression. That's awful, right? You're hearing every Democrat in the United States say this. But at the same time, what they're also saying is, but what we don't want is we don't want those radicals. Because when radicals or extremists happen, you get January 6th. Now, the language there is really important. And if we pay attention to the way that the Democrats have shifted their language since January, you can see this really clearly. They're no longer talking about right-wing extremists. They're just talking about, quote, extremists. Everything they want to do is, quote, anti-extremism, without a politics attached to that. And what that means and what they've been doing and what Biden did literally this week as more rioting broke out in the United States is they came out to say, well, you know, looting, that's extremism, but protesting is okay. That is a classical counterinsurgency approach. So when we combine this with the idea that the police around the United States are using the Chauvin trial as a way to re-legitimize themselves, and we combine this with the notion that the Biden administration is engaging in a form of rhetoric which informs and builds the foundations for counterinsurgency, and we already see liberal activists getting brought into the political process, all of that is straight counterinsurgency manual type techniques, right? Just straight up. We're watching this happen in liberal areas, right? As you just said, like, this is what is happening in blue parts of the United States, right? This is what's happening where I live, which is deep, deep, deep blue part of the United States, right? Working class, blue part of the United States. This is what we're seeing. You know, I was just at a demonstration this past weekend, and it was interesting because, like, they had a bunch of politicians talk at the beginning, because this is a protest against the protest laws in the state I live in. They had a bunch of politicians speak. And then they had a bunch of anarchists speak, like right after that. And the anarchists that were speaking were talking about a very different message than what the politicians were saying. And the politicians, what they were saying is, we need to protect, quote, peaceful protest. If we have extremism, well, obviously, there's already laws about rioting. Like, if you need a law about rioting, that's already illegal. Like, we should just, like, reimpose those laws about rioting. But, you know, we need legitimate protests, right? That language is spectacularly dangerous, right? At that demonstration, there were liberals in the crowd that went to people that were doing security at that march and asked them to report the anarchists to the police simply because we were there. Not even doing anything. We were just standing around in a park. And they wanted to report us to the police because we are extremists. And the thing that the person said was, quote, well, you know, you see something, you say something, right? Which was a slogan that the US government used in 2001 to try and draft regular everyday citizens into counterterrorism. This is where liberals have gone. And so we wonder why it doesn't feel like anything's changing under a Biden administration. The reality is that nothing is. That at the end of the day, at its core, we are still watching all of the foundational parts of American life that have generated the problems that we talked about on this show still perpetuate. And we are watching an administration reinforce them at every single possible turn. And this just goes to enforce the idea that us as radicals that are engaged in the struggle are not fighting the same fight that liberals are. We are not even most of the time on the same side, right? And we definitely cannot trust them, because liberals in the United States are engaged in a broad discourse which is justifying counterinsurgency. And they are directly complicit in all of that.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.